Well, I'm tending to record a brief discussion about viral epidemics and vaccinations. I've been asked so many questions over the last period of time that I thought it'd be easier to simply record an introductory presentation that people who are interested can listen to and hopefully become better informed and maybe even a little enthusiastic about the wonderful, fascinating field of virology, which is part of the fascinating world around us. Although in this case, of course, part of the fascination is the danger. So what I'd like to do is to divide this discussion into two parts. I'm going to aim it at people who are have little or no medical background. Those of you who have a professional background will forgive me for some of the detail. But I'm going to do this in two parts. First of all, I'd like to cover a little bit of the field of virology and viral epidemics and epidemics in general to give a feel for this area. And then, after explaining the medical facts and what can be done to protect us against some of these dangers, try to deal a little bit with the correct Torah attitude towards facing these dangers and what should and should not be done. Try to explain a little bit about what is a halachic question in this area, what's not a halachic question. Try to make that plain and hopefully leave people better informed. What I'm not going to do is get personal. This is no place here for attacking anyone on an ad hominem level. In fact, anyone doing that in this area is completely beyond the pale of any discussion. This is a factual area that needs to be understood clearly. Anybody descending to the level of insulting anyone else on a personal basis, of course, is really not part of the discussion. Probably has no place in an Orthodox Torah world of discourse anyway. So, not going to try to point any fingers in a personal way. Just going to try to cover this area, give a general background, which I hope you'll find informative and interesting, and try to lay out some of the Orthodox or Torah attitude to this area. So, first of all, let's take a brief tour through virology and viral epidemics and get a bit of a feel for this area, how the field works, and what exactly are its dangers. You're probably aware that this year marks the 100th anniversary of the disastrous viral flu epidemic, the 1918 flu, sometimes called the Spanish flu, interesting historical reasons for that, which I won't go into. But it was a devastating worldwide event known as a pandemic. In fact, probably the most lethal single lethal event that mankind experienced. Certainly more people died than during the Black Death, although it's true that the Black Death killed more people in terms of the human population at the time. But just to give a feel for the power and fearsomeness of viral epidemics, the influenza epidemic of 1918 killed at least 50 million people. Some opinions put it at 100 million worldwide. It was a frightening and a rapid spread of flu. Just to give a little bit of a technical background, the problem, one of the classic problems in virology dealing with the influenza, is that the flu virus mutates and constantly changes. The reason we don't have an effective single vaccine against flu is because every year the strain that sweeps across the world is a different strain. Flu is characterized by two different antigens, the H and the N antigens, without, again, going into too much of the technicality. And so you have a strain of virus which might be H1N1 or H2N2 or H1N3 or whatever it is, almost endless possibility of combinations. And unfortunately, there's little cross-immunity from one strain to another, which means that you might have been exposed to one strain of flu, and the next year a different one will sweep through the world, and your immunity will be very, very inadequate because the strain will be not the same one that was occurring the year before. The problem with the vaccines, of course, the challenge with the vaccines is to try to predict early in the season which strain of flu will be spreading across the world so that vaccines can be produced in time for the vulnerable so that they can be vaccinated that season. Sometimes we get that right and sometimes we don't. But anyway, the epidemic was fearsome. Flu, as you know, is usually a relatively mild illness, but in 1918, and this happens to be a phenomenon, by the way, that cycles with a periodicity of a few decades, where a particularly virulent strain of flu sweeps across the world. Almost the whole world is involved. In fact, in 1918, people died in the Arctic and Antarctic areas and islands. Virtually no one was spared. Virtually no country was spared. And the flu itself happened to be particularly virulent, but most people died from secondary infections like bacterial pneumonia. And of course, it wasn't possible to know which people would get that and which wouldn't. There were no antiviral drugs at the time, although even today the antiviral drugs we have are not completely effective. And the case fatality rate for influenza at the time was about 1 to 2%, which means that of every 100 people who got influenza, so about 1 or 2% would die. Now, that's a low case fatality rate, but when you're talking about millions of people infected, you're talking about hundreds of thousands, and in fact, millions of people who would die. As in most flu epidemics, the most vulnerable were the very young, under age 5, and the older, over age 60, 65, 70. But for some inexplicable reason, into 1918, there was a high spike of fatalities among the 20 to 40-year-old age group as well. Still not understood to this day, even though decades of research have gone into that epidemic. So what happened was, between July and October — the epidemic started before that in 1918, but between July and October, which is quite unusual, by the way, usually influenza is worse in the winter, but over the summer months of 1918, it swept across the world, and every family had someone who died or knew someone who died. Well over 500,000 Americans died. In fact, in many parts of the world, people were being buried by bulldozer and in mass graves. There were many parts of the world where people couldn't be buried adequately. The fatalities were just too numerous, and it was an absolutely terrifying epidemic that spread across the world. The virology experts will tell you that it's not a question of if such a pandemic will happen again, it's a question of when. Part of the logic of pandemics is probably that there is some immunity left from previous pandemics, certainly for the particular strain that was the one that caused the epidemic. And so people who are a few decades beyond that epidemic will retain some immunity. But of course, as they age and move on, and the world becomes populated largely by people not being exposed to that strain, then of course we're in danger of another pandemic. So that is the situation with influenza, a sobering reminder this year of what a worldwide epidemic can do. Flu, of course, being very infectious, and as I said, despite having a low fatality, it was nevertheless serious enough to cause millions of deaths. Some died by the overwhelming influenza itself and the body's reaction, extreme reaction to the influenza, but as I say, most died of secondary infections, and that is what happened 100 years ago. We are still, as I said, this has to be understood clearly, we're still in danger of another pandemic because we don't have a universal influenza vaccine. Research has been put into that, but the best we can do so far is try to keep one step ahead of the vaccine each year. The 1918 flu probably began in geese and wildfowl. A big debate whether where exactly it began, was it Asian birds or not, so-called Asian flu. Nevertheless, it spread rapidly throughout the developed world, despite the fact that travel was not as advanced and globalization was not as smooth and seamless as it is today. Nevertheless, that is what happened, and there's a wide consensus that a pandemic of that sort today would spread even more rapidly because of our shrinking globalized world. So that is to introduce our subject of pandemic infections, particularly viral infections. Let's take a look at another disease, viral disease, in which we had a brilliant result due to vaccination, and that is smallpox. Again, trying to give a little bit of a historical background here so that people can understand some of virulence and population characteristics of epidemics and pandemics. Smallpox was a disastrous illness a couple hundred years ago. Widespread epidemics of smallpox, and people who significant mortality rate, and not only mortality, but of course people were badly scarred by smallpox because it has the rash of smallpox, the skin effect of smallpox, which looks largely like chickenpox, is scarring the skin very badly. So the people who survived were often very badly scarred. And of course, the facial scarring was the worst. But that was the smallpox. Now, in the late 1700s, the 1790s, Edward Jenner was able to develop a vaccination, and he's known as the father of vaccination in Britain. And the classic story, of course, about him, which may or may not be true, is that Edward Jenner recognized that milkmaids in England had very good skins. It was very common to see people scarred by survivors of smallpox who were badly scarred, and the milkmaids, he noticed, had very good skins. Apocryphal story, which, as I said, may or may not be true, as many of these stories are. Edward Jenner discovered and realized that what was unique about milkmaids was that they were getting infected with cowpox. Now, cowpox is a viral illness, much less virulent and dangerous than smallpox, and they were getting infected with a cowpox, and they were not getting smallpox. So Jenner realized that just like a person wouldn't get smallpox twice, because the first infection would protect you against the second one, the body would be left with antibodies, although the science of antibodies wasn't yet known and developed at that time. But it was known that someone who'd been infected would be immune later. Jenner hypothesized that the cowpox was in fact similar enough to the smallpox that people who had the cowpox would not get smallpox. And of course that led him to the brilliant idea of deliberately giving people cowpox in such a way that they would be protected subsequently to smallpox. And of course that's what happened. There are many stories about whom he tried it on, and the first patient that he gave it to, and you can look up the fascinating story of Edward Jenner. There's even at least one tshuva from the 1800s, one halachic response, in which refers to him as HaChassid Jenner, amazingly. Right, there was a rabbi writing in the 1800s, calls him a righteous man, Jenner, who developed the smallpox vaccine, which was based on a cowpox virus, and it turned out to be dramatically effective, and he led, in fact, to the elimination of smallpox. That's a remarkable thing to note. Smallpox, one of the very, very few, perhaps the only real disease that has actually been eliminated. And the reason that you can do that with a disease like smallpox is because it's carried by humans only. Unlike the cowpox, the smallpox is a human, the pool, the reservoir of the infection is only human. When you're dealing with diseases that that have animal hosts as well, like the early HIV virus, which was found in monkeys, various other sleeping illness, for example, sleeping sickness, which is hosted by animals and by humans. That's not a viral disease, but just to give you an example, when you deal with an illness that is which is carried in a host reservoir of animals or insects or other parts of the environment as well as humans, it may be very, very difficult to eliminate. But when you deal with a disease, measles happens to be one of these too, which means theoretically it could be conquered totally, and we'll come to that in due course. But smallpox was a disease that was harbored by humans only. And therefore, the thinking was that if you could break the cycle, if you could rid the world of smallpox for a brief period of time, in other words, a situation where no one would be infected, there'd be no infectivity. Of course, nobody would be infecting anyone else. And if you could maintain that for just a brief moment in time, you'd break the cycle of smallpox transmission and actually end the disease. And sure enough, that's what happened. There was an international effort. Tremendous credit to the healthcare establishments around the world, with all the political problems and all the distrust and all the all the difficulties and obstructions that we find in these areas, despite all that, smallpox was conquered, vaccination was dramatically successful around the world, and it was a tremendous international effort to vaccinate everyone around the world. And in the 1980s, by 1988, I think it was, the world was declared free of smallpox. I think the last, if I'm not mistaken, in 1980, around mid 1980s, vaccination was stopped all around the world. There were no more cases. I think the last case, if I remember correctly, was a healthcare worker somewhere around 1989, exposed in a lab. And since that time, since the 1980s, there have been no recorded cases in throughout the world. That's quite amazing to think. If you see you look up photographs, you'll see people with smallpox, very, very disfiguring and terrifying disease. And in fact, that is one of the real triumphs of modern medicine, which was the worldwide program of smallpox vaccination. Today the debate about smallpox, today people are not vaccinated against smallpox, not necessary. There's no wild type smallpox virus around. And so there has been one scourge of humanity that has been conquered. The debate that continues about smallpox today is something that didn't really concern us here, just mentioned out of interest. That is that the only place that smallpox virus exists today is in one American and one Russian top security virology lab. It is kept in case research will ever need to be done in the future. And the debate that rages today is whether those last samples should be destroyed so that the world will never see smallpox again, or whether they should be maintained in case they'll ever be needed. Why would they ever be needed? One of the most explicit fears here is bioterrorism, that if anybody would get hold of smallpox virus and spread it around the world in an unimmunized international population, of course you could cause absolute havoc, and that is a fear. So the debate that continues among virologists today is it better to destroy all known samples of smallpox so that are very unlikely to happen, or is it better to keep them in the event of emergency? Of course, the downside of keeping it is that they may be, although they're kept under top secrecy and top security, they may be targets for bioterrorists who may try to take those last remaining samples and cause, of course, havoc using those samples. At the moment, the samples are still maintained, and that's the status of smallpox research and smallpox prevention today. So this is a, as opposed to flu, where we have not come up with a total solution, smallpox is a disease that was eradicated. So that gives you a little bit of a feel for the history of immunization, vaccination, going back to Jenner's time in England, the late 1700s. And that was the original idea of getting the body to produce antibodies to a disease so that when the disease strikes, the body will be prepared and prevent entry of the virus into its cells, or if the virus gets into the body's cells, it will be destroyed. So let's come a little closer to the modern era and talk about polio and measles. Of course, we can't discuss all our viral threats that face us, or all epidemic threats, but just to give a feel, measles happens to be the one that is of most interest currently. But of course, if we drop our guard and lower immunization rates, of course we become exposed not only to measles, but of course to all the epidemic and pandemic infections, and particularly viral infections that we've mentioned. Let's take a brief look at polio. Polio, poliomyelitis, which really means inflammation of the gray matter of the spinal cord and the brain. Polio is a viral infection. The virus, like all viruses, attacks cells. Viruses, as you probably know, are submicroscopic. They're much, much smaller than bacteria. In fact, there are viruses that infect bacteria, quite amazingly. And what the virus does is it is tiny, tiny submicroscopic, ultramicroscopic particle. It doesn't even have the components of a cell. It breaks into, enters a cell and uses the cell's machinery to do its nefarious work. It uses the genetic material mechanisms of the cell to produce everything that it needs to replicate, and then when it breaks out, usually killing the cell in the process, having multiplied millionfold, it then, of course, goes on to infect many, many other cells. Now, the polio, and of course the routes of entry of each viral disease are different. Polio is an enterovirus, which means that it is ingested. It is a hygiene problem, usually from fecal-oral spread in washing water, people swimming in the same rivers and lakes or pools, as opposed to measles, which is a respiratory virus, which you get from droplet spread, namely coughing, sneezing, infected hands, from having touched nose and mouth. So polio is an enterovirus, and much more common in the summer. And polio is a terrifying disease as well. The polio virus has a predilection for a particular type of cell in the spinal column, spinal cord, which leads to paralysis, usually a mild illness which does not give paralysis, but a very significant percentage of people who get polio get a paralysis of parts of the spinal cord, which lead to paralysis of the extremities, often the legs, usually one leg more than the other, not usually symmetrical, but it can be. And of course, the paralysis can ascend; it can affect the lower extremities, but it can also affect higher parts of the spinal cord. The most feared, probably, or among the most feared, is when the poliovirus actually affects a higher part of the thoracic cord, so that the person cannot breathe. The victim is dies of suffocation because the respiratory muscles are completely paralyzed. And it can also infect a higher part of the spinal cord, namely what's called bulbar paralysis, where the muscles that are needed for speaking and swallowing are also affected, so that people who have that form of, or a combination of forms, they're unable to swallow, and not able to breathe, not able to swallow. And of course, that's a terrifying and gruesome suffering and death. So polio, again, epidemic until the modern era. In fact, people who are old enough remember the fear that gripped young people every summer. Polio much more common in the summer outbreaks. Rabbi Meiselman recently described his memories of as being an American child, when every summer the fear circulated through the community, not only the Jewish community, of course, and everyone wondered every summer who was not going to survive the summer, who'd get polio, who would die, who'd be paralyzed. And of course, large numbers of American children and children around the world ended up either dying of polio or ended up in what was called an iron lung. The iron lung was a large contraption looking like an enormous washing machine or dryer. Child was inserted into the machine. As I said, that the paralysis of polio sometimes was transient, but in many cases, of course, was not transient and never recovered, the cells having died in that part of the anterior part of the spinal cord, as it's called. Those cells would have died and a person paralyzed permanently. So the children were put into these... it was more serious, in fact, when it happened in adults, but whichever the case was, the victim was put into a negative pressure iron lung, which sucked the chest out, so that it was an artificial form of breathing. Of course, you can imagine the anxiety and the miserable existence that was. Subsequently, there were more efficient devices that were worn around the chest, but of course, many of those people died. You can imagine the fear of a simple thing like a power failure or a mechanical failure. Of course, a person would die of asphyxiation. So that's the experience. You speak to people like Rabbi Meiselman or people who lived through that. People of that era will tell you that the two fears that Americans had every summer, the two main fears that Americans had, were polio in the summer and the general fear of nuclear war. That was the 1950s and early 1960s. That was the... Those were the things that you faced. Now, what happened in terms of vaccination, polio vaccination, again, another dramatic success story. There are two well-known individuals, Albert Sabin and Jonas Salk. These are two individuals who came up with the idea of developing vaccines against polio. The Salk vaccine, Salk and Sabin were both Jewish, by the way. Jonas Salk, if I'm not mistaken, studied at NYU in New York. He was first generation born American. I think his mother was come over from Poland. His father, I think, was born in America as well. He was graduated in medicine in the 1930s, and he became a virologist, became fascinated, Jonas Salk, fascinated with virology, and went on to discover and develop the Salk vaccine. Now, the Salk vaccine against polio was a vaccine that needed to be injected. It was a killed vaccine, meaning that it had no ability to infect the person who was being vaccinated, but it was enough of the pathological or the viral components to stimulate the body to make antibodies, so that when polio was ingested, it would find the antibodies ready, and antibodies would, although the virus was able to enter the cells and be rapidly killed, and was a very effective vaccine. In about 1955, Jonas Salk began his experiments in widely vaccinating people. The first children who were vaccinated were institutionalized children, for various reasons. Turned out to be safe, extremely safe, and became a very, very widespread vaccine. And of course, what happened as soon as the vaccine became widespread in the United States and around the world, the polio incidence dropped dramatically. In fact, over the next few decades, polio was virtually wiped out. In fact, there's tremendous hope that polio, in fact, it's been declared by the World Health Organization as a target for eradication. And there are parts of the world where polio has not been seen for decades. That is the original so-called Salk vaccine. Now, Albert Sabin, another Jewish virologist, also a New Yorker, Sabin was actually born in Poland, but he emigrated to the United States. His name was actually Saperstein, but he changed it to Sabin when he came to America. He was actually Avram. Saperstein was his name, Abraham or Avram, but he became Albert, Albert Sabin. He took a middle name, Bruce. It was really required for Americans to have a middle name or middle initial. I think that Salk also took Edward, I think, was his middle name. Jewish immigrants to the United States felt that it was necessary to take a middle name or an initial. But anyway, Avram Saperstein, known to us as Albert Sabin, developed a different vaccine, which he was convinced was superior to the Salk vaccine. And what Sabin did was he used a live virus. He was able to passage his polio virus through many different generations and weaken it. He was able to weaken it so that it would be you'd be able to give it to a person who would then become infected with a very, very weak form of polio. Weak enough that it would not be dangerous, but strong enough, a real enough infection that the body would produce antibodies. And this is the famous Sabin vaccine. Also during the 1950s, by 1960, he was able to convince the health authorities in the United States that his vaccine was superior to the Salk vaccine, and Sabin's vaccine became the vaccine of choice. It was heavily debated which was the best, which was the better one. Some countries, actually until quite recently, were actually giving both of these, both for various reasons without going to the complicated reasons for that. But the Sabin vaccine turned out to be the predominant one, a live vaccine, and that was internationally used around the world. The advantage of the Sabin vaccine is that it actually prevents viral entry into the cells, but probably its biggest advantage is that it's an oral vaccine, so you just need to give a couple of drops in a child's mouth. There's no injection needed, extremely simple, can be rapidly and very easily done. You don't need sterile syringes and so forth. Made it possible to have an international program of vaccinating children around the world. There is one downside, a downside of the Sabin vaccine that's important to know, and I mentioned this for a particular reason, and that is to make it clear that vaccines are not perfect. Despite the dramatic successes of something like the smallpox vaccine and the very dramatic effect of something like a polio vaccine, vaccines are not perfect. They have a few downsides. One of the downsides of many vaccines, polio included, is that the immunity you get from the vaccine may not be quite as good as the immunity you get from the natural infection. With measles, for example, it's been noted that, just to give you one example, people who've actually had measles, mothers who've had measles, so the antibodies cross in the placenta to the fetus, and when the child's born, the child is protected for the first few months of life by antibodies that the child gets from its mother. That seems to be more effective in mothers who've had the natural disease than mothers who are simply passing antibodies that were generated by vaccination. So there is a possibility, and in some viral diseases this is quite well established, that the immunity you get from a natural infection may be better and more durable than the immunity you get from a vaccine. Despite that, of course, it's a downside that is willingly accepted, because to get the benefit of the natural infection, you of course have to sacrifice many lives. Right? We'll talk about the case fatality of measles, but if you're going to accept a disease like polio, and in pre-industrial societies where kids swim in the river together, and they all get polio at a very young age, so those kids have excellent immunity when they grow up, and of course that's wonderful, but the downside is some of them die, some of them get paralyzed. So society has decided that although the immunity generated by the vaccine may not be quite as good as the natural or the wild type viral immunity, nevertheless, of course, that trade-off is eminently worthwhile. Another danger of the Sabin vaccine, even though it's a predominantly used vaccine, is that because it's a live virus, there's a very small possibility that the live immune strain, the vaccine strain, can actually mutate and become a disease-causing virus in its own right. And this does happen, in one in many hundreds of thousands of cases of kids immunized do in fact get ill, and some of them get a disease that can be quite as bad as the original disease. This is well known, and it's a very unfortunate side effect and complication of the Sabin vaccine. Again, this is chosen knowingly and done deliberately and knowingly, because the price you pay for the occasional child who will be harmed by the vaccine, the price you pay is that, and the gain you have, of course, is the hundreds and thousands of children who will not be infected. Now, this policy of using this live vaccine or a combination of the vaccines led to the fact that in the last couple of decades, polio has been virtually eradicated around the world. Again, it's an infection that is in humans only, and therefore is a suitable target for complete elimination. And so internationally, about 10 to 20 years ago, the world community reported a virtual elimination of polio around the world entirely. Unfortunately, it didn't quite reach the stage where it was eliminated. A couple of reasons for that. Let me just add here something very interesting, is that in 2017, for the first time, a vaccine-induced polio became more common than natural polio. Let me explain that. That means if you look at the United States population in 2017, there were a few cases of kids getting paralyzed or getting ill with polio, and they were virtually all cases caused by the vaccine. Of course, to the unsophisticated, unmedically trained anti-vaccination people, some of them will say, you see how dangerous this vaccine is, and it is far worse than the disease. Why is it far worse than the disease? Because the disease is not causing any harm now, and all the harm is caused by the vaccine. Of course, what they fail to realize is the fact that, that of course, all the harm is being caused by the vaccine, because there's no harm being caused by the disease at all. The vaccine has eliminated the disease. So no one's coming down with polio, natural polio. All you have is the occasional child who's getting polio from the vaccine. However, this is becoming unacceptable, right? It's becoming unacceptable. The feeling is that we've paid enough of a price in order to gain eradication of the disease, and therefore the virology community has largely accepted, in most parts of the world now, the live vaccine. Sabin's wonderful, extremely successful live vaccine has not been used anymore, and people have fallen back now to using the much safer killed vaccine, because the feeling is that we are as close as so close to eradication of the disease that we can afford to use the slightly less convenient but safer killed vaccine, so we don't have to expose children to the risk of vaccine-induced polio. That is the feeling. A New England Journal of Medicine reported on this about 2 or 3 months ago, that is the trend in public health today. Why has it not been completely eliminated? Unfortunately, there are 3 pockets of polio left in the world, actually 2 at the moment, one in Pakistan, one in Afghanistan. The most famous pocket of resistance was in Nigeria some years ago. What happened in Nigeria was the word began spreading that polio vaccines are actually a Western plot to sterilize black children, Nigerian children, or African children. And in response to that provocation, a number of healthcare workers were actually killed by militias in Nigeria, which actually brought a temporary halt to the vaccination program. In Pakistan and Afghanistan, there's been similar events, aided by the fact that you're talking about countries torn by civil strife, which makes the vaccination programs much more difficult. Nigeria has now achieved control, the reason being that some healthcare workers actually risked their lives with the threats against them and the killings to actually boost population immunity to the point that the disease been been eliminated. This is a constant problem, by the way. They're often in countries like that. As I say, currently Pakistan, Afghanistan, where there are suspicion that vaccine programs may be Western or anti-Muslim or anti-black or African plots to harm or sterilize children. So as we speak at the moment, at the very end of 2018, beginning of 2019, the world is almost polio-free. Almost polio-free. We cannot let our guard down yet because, as I say, there's still a few pockets. I remember while I was in medical practice in Israel some time ago, going back now 20 years or more, actually probably about 30 years, I remember an outbreak of paralytic polio in Israel because people became complacent, didn't want to vaccinate. There was a bit of a scare at the time, and so the vaccination rate dropped. And then what you got was an outbreak of polio in the country, and unfortunately there are children paralyzed today because of that. And of course the fear of seeing children ill and paralyzed led to a resurgence in the vaccination rate, and of course the problem was brought under control. So polio is a classic disease. I've mentioned influenza, which we haven't yet conquered with the vaccine, although we have an effective vaccine each year. As I say, when we one step ahead, the disease and the recommendations today are for the very young or people in institutions or elderly people to be vaccinated against influenza, pregnant women, also people, healthcare workers, very segments of the population. We've spoken about smallpox, which is probably the most dramatic public health victory in the world, possibly, eliminating a scourge of mankind and actually bringing it under complete control, breaking transmission so it's no longer part of human experience. Actually, quite an astounding result. We've spoken about polio, which is on the verge of being eliminated. There are big fears at the moment that if the anti-vaccination campaign gains enough hold, we may take a number of steps back, in which case, of course, we'll have to make step up our efforts. We'll have to possibly consider using the live Sabin vaccine again. But there are great hopes that with the international cooperation, we can actually eliminate polio. And then, of course, I imagine the debate will simply be, should we keep the polio virus in a lab, top security lab, in case we need it? Same discussion as is current with the smallpox. So that's a little bit of a background before we get to measles. Of viral epidemics, pandemics, absolutely fearsome events. Let's just talk a little bit about vaccination in the community and these epidemics in terms of vaccination. One of the important points to bear in mind here is that many young parents and young people of our generation find what I'm saying to be quite a distance from them. They've actually seen these things. You know, if you're a doctor practicing medicine and you've seen children die of measles, meningitis, and you've seen them die of mumps, or you've seen them become sterile or in agony when they get the testicular inflammation from the mumps, or you've seen kids paralyzed with polio, or kids who can't breathe or they can't swallow, These things are burnt into your consciousness as a doctor, and you never forget them. But the reason that we find many of our patients are not sensitive to this is because they've never seen it. They've grown up in a world, right? The young parents of this generation grown up in a world where smallpox completely unknown to them, polio completely unknown to them. And I heard of a Muslim, as I said, speaking to a group of young of Bochrim in his yeshiva, describing to them the fear that he used to go through every summer. About polio, speaking to a group of people, not only have they never seen a case of polio, but their parents haven't either. So one of the reasons for a falling off in vaccination is because people, in one sense, can afford to. They can afford because they don't have the fear, or the, should I say the terror, of a child becoming mentally defective due to meningitis or dying in agony by one of these very, very common viral diseases. You have to remember that child mortality now is a mere fraction of what it used to be. If you should be so minded as to take a walk in any cemetery around the world, at any cemetery that goes back, you know, 50 or 100 years, you'll see, wherever you go in the world, you'll see a very common phenomenon. You'll see a grave with a family name, and then around that grave, you'll see a number of family graves. And if you pay close attention to the dates, you'll see that many of them are children. It was very, very common throughout the world. It was very rare for a family to expect that all their children would survive. Children died from scarlet fever, they died from diphtheria, and they certainly died from the viral epidemics that spread around the world. And today, you know, we very much hope that we have to raise our children and our grandchildren, and that the death among a child will be a great rarity. Hashem should protect us from those things. But if you practice medicine in an era where you saw these things, let me remind you that the polio vaccines were only rolled out between 1955 and 1960. Right? So anybody who grew up in the 50s, you know, was exposed to these things. Today, most doctors in the developed world haven't even seen a case. For example, measles. Talk about measles. I remember a very bitterly humorous episode that occurred last year. The New England Journal of Medicine, the most prestigious journal of medicine in the world, often publishes a picture or a vignette of an illness and challenges doctors around the world to make a diagnosis. And then they publish a week or two later, they publish how many doctors got it right and how many, what right answers were given, what wrong answers were given. Quite a sobering exercise, I should say. On this particular occasion, they showed a 21-year-old man who'd returned from a trip to California with an extreme maculopapular rash. That's a blotchy red rash all over his face and body, red eyes. And they wanted a spot diagnosis from the rash. And I was absolutely amazed to see the response of American doctors. A very small percentage of American doctors were able to diagnose the disease. It was measles. And this is no discredit to the American doctors. The American doctors were looking at that picture in this prestigious journal had never seen a measles rash, right? That's a credit to the effectiveness of the vaccine campaign. I, of course, having practiced medicine in South Africa, where I was trained to diagnose measles and diagnose a measles rash in black children. Now, that's a challenge. To diagnose a measles rash in a white patient or a white child, I think, would be easier, right? But to diagnose measles in a child with a black skin, to see the rash and be able to diagnose it as a measles rash, so that takes a little bit of skill. But anyway, that was one of the ironies of our situation, and of course the journal in themselves remarked on the fact that American doctors and pediatricians, of course, did a little bit better. But I'm sorry to tell you that the successful diagnosis from that obvious measles picture in a first world medical journal got less than 50% accuracy of diagnosis. That is a testimony not to American doctors' incompetence, of course, but to the effectiveness of the vaccine. So that's one important thing to bear in mind when you talk about people anti-vaccination sentiment. One of the important things is that you speak to people in their 70s and 80s today, they think the anti-vaccination people are crazy. They think that if you could protect your child from the ravishes of and the tragedies that we saw, I mean, why wouldn't you do that? But of course, you're talking to people who have not seen these things, and they live in a world that they perceive as far, far safer than their grandparents. The next thing to be aware of is that vaccinations work. One of the important things to understand about vaccines is they work on a community basis. Let's try to understand that. very important to understand here, because we're talking about a challenge to a community, not simply a question of protecting your child, but we're talking about something broader. Not only are we talking about protecting individuals of the next generation, but we're talking about something that is a community effort and community responsibility. Let me explain this as best I can. When you get an epidemic of disease, let's talk about measles, for example. Measles has a very high infectivity rate, right? Influenza does too, by the way. But measles, talking about a household of 10 people in close contact with somebody who's got measles, 9 out of the 10 will actually be infected by the measles. Tremendously high infectivity. So you're talking about a disease that spreads from person to person, right? You're not talking about a mosquito-borne disease like dengue or malaria. You're talking about a person-to-person transmission. So somebody sneezing and coughing in close proximity to other people, this is why it spreads so rapidly in institutions, healthcare institutions and children's institutions, or in families. You're talking about a disease that is spread by person-to-person contact. Now, the way you deal with this in a from a vaccination point of view is you need to vaccinate the population. If you vaccinate enough people in the population, then you'll have enough spaces or gaps between people who are unimmunized so that the disease cannot spread. You need two things for an epidemic. You need a certain population size, and you need a certain population size or percentage of that population that are not immune to the disease. Now, it's a fact among viral diseases that you don't have to vaccinate everyone. You don't have to achieve 100% immunity. You need to achieve somewhere around 95% for some diseases, 96, 97, 98%, depending on what the disease is. In the case of measles, for example, or polio, over 95% immunity in the community will do it. Why? Because even if you have 2 or 3 or 4% of children who are not immune to the disease, spread around the community, they will be thinly spread enough that transmission will not occur jumping from one case to another. And therefore, it's impossible to hope for 100% coverage. One never achieves 100% immunity for various reasons. Some kids just don't seem to respond to the vaccine. That's, by the way, why 2 or 3 doses are given. Polio vaccination immunity rate jumps to about 99% in kids who are immunized 3 times. So that's why it's done more than once. But even the 99% is not 100%. And so some kids, for one reason or another, don't get the vaccine. Some don't respond to it as you would hope. Some children cannot be vaccinated because they have cancer, or the immune system has been hit by disease or by cancer drugs. We're much too risky to immunize them. And so there are children who are not vaccinated. But it's no problem, because as long as 95% or more of the community is immune, you will break transmission of an epidemic, and you can quite safely have cancer sufferers, kids with children with cancer or cancer treatment, and various other reasons. Whooping cough, for example, was not given to kids with neurological disease. There was a thought at the time that the whooping cough might cause neurological problems, although today there's a better vaccine. And so the logic of vaccination is that you don't need to vaccinate everyone, but you do need to get above 95%. This means that vaccination is a community effort. It's not an individual sitting with his child or his family members or deciding whether you personally should get immunized. It is a community effort where we can break transmission. When it comes to flu, it's more of a personal decision. There will be an epidemic every year in the autumn and winter. The question is which people should be protected. But when it comes to something like measles, what we're aiming to do here is not protect the individual against an epidemic, but break the transmission of an epidemic altogether so that it does not happen. And this is why it's such a hot topic and such an inflammatory topic. It's not a question simply of whether you have the right not to immunize your child, but when you do that, you have consequences for the community at large. And if enough people resist vaccination and the immunity rate drops below 95%, you get down to 94 or 90%, you will have an epidemic. And in that case, what will happen is, unfortunately, this is inevitable, there will be infection and there'll be fatalities. If 90% of the community is immune, of course, you'll have a much weaker epidemic than the type of pandemics we spoke about with influenza, but there'll still be many thousands of cases. And in the case of measles, approximately 1 in 1,000 children will have a serious complication or die from measles. Fatality rate, there'll be about 1 in 1,000. And so what will happen is, unfortunately, there will be deaths. The most likely deaths, unfortunately and tragically, will be in those immunocompromised people, like the kids with cancer, the ones who could not be vaccinated, not those who defaulted and didn't get the vaccine because they objected principle to the vaccinations, but they could not get the vaccination because they are kids with cancer or trying to recover from their cancer, going through chemotherapy. And of course, those are the children who are extremely vulnerable to the virus. Their immune system, not only they cannot be vaccinated for the very reason that they are so susceptible to infection. And of course, that leaves them as the extremely vulnerable ones. So unfortunately, here we were able to predict what will happen when the vaccine rate drops below a certain proportion. What will happen is there'll be an epidemic, as we are seeing now with measles. We've seen with polio, as I said, although they're much less of a present problem now. We're seeing it with measles. And I think the last epidemic actually was begun by two Amish men who were not immunized and came back to their community in Pennsylvania. And an outbreak spread there. I forget whether there was a measles or a polio epidemic, but I think it was a measles epidemic, and it had spread. It spread that way. They picked up the infection when they were doing some religious work, as shluchim, what do you call it, the missionaries, and came back to the community that way. So it will be spread by an unimmunized person who picks up an infection. California was a seat of infection in for measles recently, and brought back to a community where there's sufficient unimmunized people. So the prediction is, unfortunately, be an epidemic. Second prediction, unfortunately, is that children will die, very often the ones who are most vulnerable. And the third thing that will happen, of course, unfortunately, and we hope we'll never get to this, is that when young parents see children dying, then they will, of course, realize and scramble to achieve vaccination rates that are high enough to prevent spread and propagation of the epidemic. That's the one thing that will happen. Another thing that will happen probably in the long term is that when enough people, ironically and very sadly, when enough people stop immunizing their children and there's a large pool of unimmunized children, a lot of those children will develop things like autism. The reason being that autism, of course, is not caused by the measles vaccine, as very, very well known. But again, the statistically unsophisticated people think that it is. The reason is, and so many people have said this to me, it's so embarrassing when you hear it. They say, my child got a measles vaccine, and 3 days later, or one day later, they developed the first signs of autism. I mean, even if the facts are as presented, which is highly doubtful because autism doesn't begin suddenly, and of course if it begins one day after a vaccination, it's very, very, very unlikely that the vaccination did it. It doesn't work that way. But they will say there's a direct association. My child had the vaccine, and shortly after, they developed signs of autism. And therefore, if those two are so closely related in time, it must be a causative relationship. And of course, what they don't realize is that association does not mean causation. Right? Correlation does not mean causation. You can have one thing followed by another thing. There's no reason at all to suspect that the first thing caused the second. And of course, when all children in the community are immunized, then all children getting autism will be children who in whom the autism follows a vaccine. Of course it's that way. If everyone's vaccinated and there's incidence of autism, nothing to do with the vaccination, but every case of autism will follow a vaccination. And so people who don't understand this will think that the one caused the other. What will happen if there are enough unvaccinated children, which I hope never happens, but if there are enough unvaccinated children, what you then have will be cases of children getting autism who were not vaccinated. And as soon as that information spreads throughout the community, people will realize that the autism, in fact, not caused by the vaccine. The proof being that a number of children, autism is on the rise, unfortunately, although we don't exactly know why. But there will be cases of kids developing signs of autism who never were vaccinated. And then there'll have to be a forced admission that the vaccine was not the cause of the autism. Anyway, we hope it doesn't get to that. But that's a brief overview of some of the variables that are operating in terms of viral infections and the ability we have to break these epidemics with very effective vaccination. If you look at the figures for measles, let's take measles finally as an example. You look at the graphs of measles infections, you'll see that since 1960, year on year and decade on decade, a precipitous drop in measles cases in the United States. In fact, until about 5 years ago, as I said, most American pediatricians, actually young pediatricians, never seen a case unless they went overseas to practice and gained some experience elsewhere. And as I made clear even today, unless you practice in a very small pocket of measles endemic today, you will not have seen a case. The last year or two, year and a half or so, there's been an uptick. 2017, as I said, about a year ago, for the first time measles cases started to be reported in the United States, and there was a dramatic uptick in the incidence of measles, exactly paralleling the decline in vaccinations. So that unfortunately we have many, many reasons to know that in fact is a direct relationship, a direct and causal relationship. So that is the case. Measles, you should know, again, highly infectious disease, usually just painful and cause a lot of suffering to kids with an extreme rash and sore eyes and cough and very high fevers. But of course the problem is that there are plenty of kids, about 1 in 1,000, as I say, which is a low rate of death. But when you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of kids, of course, you're talking about hundreds of deaths. And if you're talking about a national epidemic, you're talking about thousands of deaths. And of course, what happens is the kids get kids will die of measles. Some will get complications like measles pneumonia. Some will get meningitis. Some die of the meningitis. Some are left permanently brain damaged by the meningitis. And that's one complication. There's another softer complication of measles, and that the evidence today suggests that people who've had measles are more prone to other infections and diseases for a year or two after the measles. But it seems to do something to the immune system that downgrades it and down-tunes it, so that people who've had measles are more susceptible to a number of other diseases in the year or two following measles. So that is the problem with measles, highly infectious and dangerous from the perspective of small proportion of people who will suffer extreme consequences. Now, the measles vaccine, very effective, developed also in the 1950s. The measles vaccine is developed by an very interesting American virologist. In the 1950s he developed the vaccine. He was an interesting character. Worked at Walter Reed, Dr. Morris Hillman, not Jewish as it happens. He developed the measles. In fact, he made an amazing number of breakthroughs. He was a very interesting individual. He made breakthrough in about 40 different viral diseases. Interesting to note, by the way, both Sabin and Salk never patented their vaccines. Didn't make a penny out of their vaccines, at least certainly Dr. Sabin. I think Salk as well did not make a penny out of it. As I say, wasn't even patented. And so, in fact, Dr. Sabin went on to found an institute in La Jolla in California, which is to this day still researches many medical problems. Anyway, Dr. Morris Hillman, some have called him the most successful vaccinologist or virologist in history. He came from Montana, and one of his main breakthroughs, probably he's best known for his measles measles vaccine. He also developed the mumps vaccine. We don't have time now to go into mumps as well. In fact, the interesting story about the mumps vaccine is that his daughter, whose name was Gerald Lynn, she came down with mumps, and he actually cultivated material that he got from his daughter, and using that, he was able to develop a mumps vaccine. The doctors know that there's a thing called the Gerald Lynn strain of mumps vaccine, which is still the one used today. So Hillman was a very interesting and forceful character, and I don't think he patented his things either, and he developed the measles vaccine. Measles vaccine, very, very effective, and today it's given with measles, mumps, and rubella. Rubella is a mild illness, but of course the problem with rubella, or so-called German measles, is not so much its consequences for the people who get it, but for pregnant women who get it. There's a high incidence of kids born with deformities, blind and deaf and various other deformities when the mother gets German measles, and so of course the attempt is to prevent an epidemic. There the strategy in the community is not only to give it to women who are pregnant or women who are young enough, in other words, the early childbearing or pre-childbearing years, but in fact the strategy is to give it to everybody so that we prevent an epidemic in the community, which means you're giving it to boys as well. And again, the societal decision has been that we'll give it to boys, even though we're not afraid of them getting German measles in any particular way, but we're doing it as a community effort to break transmission so we don't have German measles epidemics. The logic being that the occasional unvaccinated woman who's pregnant will not get German measles because it will not be an epidemic around her in the community. So that's a societal decision that has been made, and of course there's been no argument about that throughout the world. No one has objected to having a German measles vaccine given to kids who aren't going to become pregnant, like boys, because we need to do it to ensure community immunity. So that's the story of the vaccines and their tremendous effectiveness. No vaccine is perfect, and of course we wouldn't give any vaccine where we didn't have to. The tendency has been to develop more and more vaccines against more and more things, some of them, in my opinion, possibly dubious. We'll try to explain that when we come to things like the HPV vaccine. Anyway, what I've done up to this point is try to give a summary of the virology issues, epidemics, some of the scary aspects of these diseases, how they work, how the immunity works in a community, why it's a community effort, and the sort of figures and cooperation you need to prevent epidemics of these kinds, and also try to sensitize people who've been listening to this to how serious and how real these epidemics and pandemics were, and what could very well face us if we persist in avoiding vaccination and dropping our immunity.